I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah died on Friday at the age of 90. His 79-year-old half-brother Salman has succeeded him. President Obama praised Abdullah for his enduring contribution to the search for peace and met with the new king today to offer condolences. While this transition of power has been smooth, unlike other countries in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia is not immune from the problems that plague the region, including the threat of ISIS and the political turmoil in neighboring Yemen. The public flogging of blogger Raif Badawi and the public beheading of a woman named Mahsa al-Zahrani have shed light on Saudi Arabia's human rights record and its puritanical, ultra-conservative interpretation of Islam. We have two guests who have joined us in this hour of Radio Times to talk about all of this, and let me introduce them to you. Bernard Haykel is professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University, director of the Institute for Transregional Study of the Contemporary Middle East, North Africa, and Central Asia. Bernard Haykel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. And also with us is Toby Jones, associate professor of history at Rutgers University, wrote a book called Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. Toby Jones, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thank you.
You're welcome. Toby, let me begin with you. How should we remember King Abdullah?
Well, we should remember him as being a, kind of a consistently in line with how Saudi Arabia's leaders have behaved in the past. He was a kind of central figure. He was high profile. He was problematic in many respects. I don't think he was special or particular. The narrative that's taken hold in this country that he was a reformer or a moderate are probably not the most helpful frameworks through which to make sense of him.
And how about for you, Bernard?
I mean, I agree that to think of him in ideological terms is to misunderstand him and the nature of the regime that he represents. Having said that, compared to some of his brothers, he had his own personality. He was quite avuncular, quite simple in his presentation style, and anecdotally very much liked by many people in the kingdom.
And to you, Toby, as you said, in this country, he's often or has been described as a reformer. Why do you think that's the narrative in the United States?
Well, I think we have to take this narrative and what does it mean? How does it play domestically? Why would presidents from George Bush to Barack Obama signal out, Abdullah as a moderate or reformer? And I think it means more in our domestic political context. How do we make sense of our geopolitical partners? Do they steer a line that's consistent with the way we define our interests in the region? It tells us very little about how they actually behave domestically. I mean, Abdullah's kingdom was very little. It was not particularly different from its predecessors, and it's likely to be different from what will follow. It doesn't say much about how the regime or the state in Saudi Arabia behaved.
Bernard Haykel, let me quote something that President Obama said shortly after King Abdullah died. He said, as a leader, he was always candid and had the courage of his convictions. One of those convictions was his steadfast and passionate belief in the importance of the U.S.-Saudi relationship as a force for stability and security in the Middle East and beyond. Do you agree with that assessment?
I mean, yes, he was a very firm believer in a strong U.S.-Saudi relationship, not least because the United States plays a crucial role in the defense of the kingdom. And the kingdom has done extremely well. By kingdom, I mean Saudi Arabia, through that relationship. Having said that, I think President Obama and King Abdullah had sometimes an acrimonious relationship. King Abdullah once famously slammed the phone on President Obama for not sufficiently supporting President Mubarak in Egypt and letting him be overthrown. So they had their differences, and King Abdullah was also against the American invasion of Iraq. So he did not agree with American policy at all in many respects.
You were quoted in the New York Times, Bernard, saying, in a sense, keep an eye on the interior minister. First of all, who is that and what should we be watching for?
So what just happened with the death of King Abdullah is that a new succession plan has been developed by appointing a deputy crown prince. And this person is from the second generation of princes, in other words, not the sons of the founder king who died in 1953. So it's the succession has jumped a generation. And what it has done, I mean, several things. One is that it has skipped over several hundred princes, all of whom have felt entitled to become king, by giving it to this fairly young individual, who's an extremely powerful individual as Minister of the Interior. He has security forces at his disposal. He has tremendous information on everyone in the country. And he only has daughters, so he will not be thinking of his own sons to succeed him. So there are many kind of attributes to the man that favor this regime and that essentially guarantee, on paper at least, its longevity for another 20 or 30 years.
To you, Toby, if Saudi Arabia didn't have oil, and of course the oil economy is changing pretty dramatically, even as we speak, but if Saudi Arabia didn't have oil, would we have this closer relationship with this country?
Well, it's hard to imagine that we would. You know, Saudi Arabia has been important. Oil is the primary reason, the primary framework and lens through which we should understand U.S.-Saudi relations, both at the political and at the corporate level. But it also played another role, somewhat related to oil in the Cold War because of its position, but also its ability to flex its muscles in places like Central Asia and Africa in the 1980s. But no, I think the relationship would be fundamentally different. But so would the U.S. relationship in the Middle East more generally. It would look very, very different. And so Saudi Arabia's position in the regional hierarchy and list of American priorities would not resemble what it does today.
So while oil prices have tumbled and the United States, I believe, is now the number one producer of oil, how does that change that relationship, Toby?
Well, I don't think it changes it yet. I think what you've identified is true, of course, that the United States, partly because of high oil prices over the last decade or so, has been able to tap into what is called unconventional sources of oil and natural gas, mostly through hydraulic fracturing, as well as Canadian efforts to tap the tar sands and elsewhere. So technological expenses that couldn't be met historically were made possible through high energy prices, and that brought more oil onto the market. Price reductions that we've seen recently maybe have something to do with Saudi geopolitical considerations. Maybe it has to do with its unwillingness to lose market share. It's hard to really know whether it's market fundamentals or whether it's politics. Hmm. I don't think it necessarily changes anything, though, at the level of the relationship. It's too hard to change things radically and fundamentally. And as Obama said either yesterday or this morning, Saudi Arabia is still important, aside from oil and matters of counterterrorism, as well as the role that we all perceive it to play, or that some perceive it to play in guaranteeing stability in the Middle East more generally, which is kind of a code word for being an obstacle to Iranian expansion.
Well, and I do want to talk about some of the regional players, but to you, Bernard Hagel, anything you want to add to that, to what Toby Jones has said?
No, I mean, I agree with most of it. I would say, though, it is market fundamentals that have driven the price of oil down simply because of U.S. production has meant that about 1 to 2 million barrels of extra surplus is on the market. And the Saudis have not been willing to cut back their own production because they're fearful of market share. That happens to also punish Iran and Venezuela and Russia and even the shale industry here in this country. But that's an unintended consequence of their policy.
But doesn't that mean they're losing money, a sense, on their number one export?
Yes, it does mean that they're losing money and they are in a budgetary deficit right now. But they've in the mid-80s, they experienced a similar situation, and they cut back production then and lost considerable market share. And so they've internalized some of the lessons of the of oil pricing and oil history and don't want to repeat it.
I wonder, though, for you, Toby Jones, and also for you, Bernard Haeckel, we've got the president in Saudi Arabia today offering condolences for the death of King Abdullah. We know this blogger was flogged, and he's going to be flogged again. This blogger, Raif Badawi. And, how do we reconcile the kind of friendship we have this country and the treatment of people, Toby Jones, who are in any way critical of the religious political government system in Saudi Arabia?
Well, I mean, we have to be careful who we mean by we. I think, I think for people like me and observers, that kind of follow along, observe critically from a distance, this is deeply problematic. It's troubling in many ways. And one wonders if it's necessary. It's not necessary to condone the kingdom behaving in this way. But policymakers in the U.S. have a very different view of it. They have a narrower framework, and they think through the language and the sort of sets of interests. And as Obama said, the U.S. feels like it has to balance, and it makes choices about prioritizing this relationship in spite of the way Saudi Arabia behaves. And I'll add one note.
Sure.
That is, given the moment, say the last 4 or 5 years through the Arab uprisings and what's followed, the rise of ISIS in Syria, it's not as though American policymakers – rightly or wrongly, feel like they're in a position where they can provoke a diplomatic crisis with Saudi Arabia because it violates human rights. American policymakers don't think in ideological terms like that. And so they're simply not going to be critical, and they're not going to distance themselves, even though they probably could.
I mean, Bernard, this seems like the behavior that we see with ISIS, you know, the beheading of people, for instance. I think almost 20 people have been beheaded in Saudi Arabia. Again, this flogging of this blogger. How are we supposed to understand this? What, you know, it just feels like, as I said, feels like ISIS. It also feels so medieval.
Well, I mean, it is the implementation of a particular interpretation of Islamic law. And in that respect, both ISIS and Saudi Arabia, I mean, share something similar in the way they understand scripture. ISIS, of course, is much more radical than the Saudis and much more willing to commit violence. Both, you know, the Saudis even historically never actually did what ISIS has done. For instance, they were also not interested in establishing a caliphate. I think, however, you know, the Saudis also punish a lot of Islamists, and they're just as opposed to the regime as the liberal bloggers. And I think the United States is quite happy that some of the al-Qaeda type people are being beheaded or tortured and so on. It's not a problem, right? So we have to be very careful, I think, as Americans, when we call for human rights violations to stop, when we seem clearly happy when some people have their human rights violated, but not others. And then the last thing I wanted to add is that, you know, the United States inherited a policy in this region from the British, and basically took upon itself, that is the U.S., took upon itself the willingness and desire to protect the oil assets that are in this region. And they represent about 60% of the proven reserves of oil in the world, of conventional reserves. And that's a price that the U.S. is paying by mobilizing two aircraft battle carrier groups there on a permanent basis. And that's the lifeblood of capitalism.
Toby, is that why we don't see, you know, I am or we are Raif T-shirts in this country?
Yeah, I mean, I think Bernard's right, you know, that there are a lot of complexities here. But let's also keep in mind, I mean, it's fascinating to kind of watch the drama and the media respond to Badawi's case more recently. It's not as though this is new. And Professor Heichel is right, of course, that there are others that were ideologically antagonistic toward that are treated similarly. But let's also keep clearly in sight that the U.S. tortured people in Guantanamo. So it's not as though there's moral clarity or distance between how the Bush and Obama administration have behaved towards those they consider political dangers and the way the Saudis have. We're too quick to lump the Saudis into ISIS's category and try to create distance between them and us. This might be an occasion to be both critical of them and ourselves.
And I do want to pick up on that, but first a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia. Saudi King Abdullah died on Friday. The president either was in or is in Saudi Arabia today to offer condolences. Talking with Toby Jones, associate professor of history at Rutgers University, and Bernard Heichel, professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. And stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, again talking with Toby Jones. He's an associate professor of history at Rutgers University. Wrote a book called Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. Bernard Heichel, professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University, director of the Institute for Transregional Study of the Contemporary Middle East, North Africa, and Central Asia. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I see emails coming in at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Bernard, let me go back to you. I'm actually looking at a headline from the New York Times. This goes back to September. It says, ISIS's harsh brand of Islam is rooted in austere Saudi creed. And we know that headlines can be misleading and can obviously lose some of the complexity. But you're quoted as talking about ISIS as a kind of untamed Wahhabism. Can you explain that for us?
All right. So, yes, I mean, I can. ISIS's version of Islam is called Salafism. And with a very strong kind of emphasis on violence or what is called jihad. Their sources, their texts their references are almost entirely Arabian. And that's both because that's what they where they come from intellectually, but also because they're trying to appeal to a constituency in Arabia of young men and women to join them, to fund them. So intellectually, the genealogy of ISIS comes out of Arabia and out of this movement called Wahhabism, except that it's a much more violent and radical version of it. They take the texts of Revelation, especially the violent ones, extremely seriously.
Well, if we go back to Wahhabism, what is the goal, if I can put it that way, and what is the appeal?
Right. So Wahhabism is a movement that started in the 18th century in Arabia, and it was a reform movement, and the reform was of other Muslims. It was a theologically motivated movement that became political, and it was to allow for the conquest of most of Arabia and the reform of Muslims that were deemed to be wayward in their belief and practices. So they target, the Wahhabis are particularly against Sufis, the cult of saints, anything that they, Shiites as well, Shiites, anyone that they feel whose beliefs or practices in some way violates the doctrine of the oneness of God.
Toby Jones, how do you see currently the relationship between, the clerics that support this version of Islam and the government in Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, I think Bernard captured it very well. I mean, I think we need to be careful in distinguishing between, as you framed the question, the clerics and those who might be inclined to embrace or articulate a particularly severe form or interpretation of Wahhabism, whether they're in Saudi Arabia or in Syria or Iraq supporting ISIS, the Saudis and between the Saudi state. And the Saudi state has a problematic relationship with its clerics. And while it provides them plenty of space to speak publicly and sometimes to provide some support for groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda and others, it also is antagonistic towards them. And most Saudi leaders are not particularly ideological. They're practical and pragmatic. They're worried about their own self-preservation. And so they're engaged in this kind of struggle to maintain their own security and stability in positions of privilege while also pushing back against radicals within their midst. So I think it's a bit misleading to suggest that ISIS's ideology is rooted in Saudi Arabia. It's rooted in a complicated relationship between Wahhabism and the Saudi state. And the Saudi state can't always control the most radical and the most violently inclined in its midst.
Why, Toby, can't women, though, drive in Saudi Arabia? Is that because of the government or because of the clerics?
Well, it's because of an accommodation that the government makes with the clerics. I mean, the clerics are powerful, and we shouldn't forget that. They exert a tremendous amount of influence. In many ways, they control the public sphere, and the Saudi state makes that possible. It allows no dissent or no criticism and few alternative voices like Badawi or others. And the state does that for lots of reasons. It's an easy way, or at least it's the easiest way they calculate, to control the public order without allowing for the proliferation of possible challenges. And women are sacrificed in a domestic political struggle between competing forces in Saudi Arabia. We need to understand that Saudi Arabia is a complicated, heterogeneous place with lots of divergent and dissenting voices. But who gets to speak credibly and publicly is much more limited. And women's issues are often are sacrificed in the interest of the royal family. I'm trying to accommodate the worst in its that are at play in the mosques and elsewhere.
And I'm curious, Bernard, how Wahhabism or the people that promote it, how do they see the United States, or do they?
A typical Wahhabi is much more concerned with other Muslims and the wayward ways of other Muslims than he is with Americans or non-believers, or what they consider to be non-believers. And traditionally, Wahhabis were not really interested in politics, international or regional politics. They were much more locally centered in their attention and in their attempt to reform. That changed, though, in the 80s and 90s when a new kind of Wahhabi emerged that was much more politicized and much, much more critical of the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States. Now, that type of Wahhabi has been essentially persecuted by the regime, and many of their leaders were in prison or are still in prison, and they've been silenced. So a typical Wahhabi today, especially from the religious establishment, will have nothing to say about the United States.
We have an email from Peter. He says, in explorations of the roots of terrorism, the promotion worldwide of Wahhabism has been said to have laid the groundwork for the amped version, or to put it another way, the Islam of ISIS, the Taliban, and others is said to have its roots in Wahhabism that has been spread through Saudi-sponsored madrasas. That's little convoluted comment there, but nonetheless, he's making the connection between ISIS and some of these extreme forms of Islam and also Wahhabism. Can you do that, Toby?
Well, yes, Saudi Arabia has provided material support for the spread of Wahhabism globally. I mean, there's no question about that. Has it promoted the spread of Al-Qaeda and jihadism? No, it has not, or at least it has not done so in the way that Al-Qaeda and ISIS and others have embraced it. That's not to excuse the Saudis. But again, I want to sort of bring us back and think about this carefully historically. The United States did exactly the same thing, was a powerful partner and patron in all of this. And do we view the United States as an ideological actor? Not necessarily. We view it as pursuing geopolitical interests and strategic concerns globally. So we often reduce Saudi Arabian politics to this kind of ideological framework, religious framework of making sense of things. And it obscures more than it reveals, I think.
Well, to you, Bernard Haeckel, and this goes back to 2001, the 9/11 terror attacks. Most of the hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. What are we supposed to make of that? I realize that's, 12, 13 years ago.
Yeah, I fully agree with what Professor Jones just said. You know, to look to monocausal explanations for why jihadism is now so prominent is wrong. There are many reasons for the rise of jihadism. I mean, in the case of Iraq, the American invasion was one very important factor for why we see ISIS today. And as far as 9/11 is concerned, yes, 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis, but that was a deliberate decision by Al-Qaeda and by bin Laden himself to try to create a rift or a wedge between the United States and Saudi Arabia. So it was a deliberate, he could have chosen, 15 others. Al-Qaeda had many nationalities among its recruits, and the Saudis were chosen for that specific purpose.
Let me reintroduce the two of you and also give out the phone number again. That's Bernard Haeckel. He's a professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. Also with us, Toby Jones, associate professor of history at Rutgers University. We are talking about Saudi Arabia. It has been in the news. King Abdullah died on Friday. The president either is in Saudi Arabia as I speak or certainly was there earlier today. And we've been talking about the relationship between these two countries, also talking about our understanding of Wahhabism and the particular form of religion that is practiced by some members of Saudi Arabia. And we have talked a bit about the blogging, the blogger who has been flogged, Raif Badawi, also a woman named Mousa al-Zahrani, who was beheaded recently, and talking about what this all means and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We have a Facebook comment from Jane. She says, what a disgrace, paying respects rather than demanding human rights, especially for women in this terrible place that is only of import because of oil. It seems only Merkel retained integrity. Good for her. Do you want to take that, Toby Jones?
Well, I'm sympathetic. I mean, I agree that we can have and should pursue a more critical line with Saudi Arabia on its human rights record. It's an abusive, oppressive regime. And I think that there is space for us to think and talk through all of those things. So I'm fully supportive of that kind of more open and frank discussion.
Why do you think, maybe it's happening behind the scenes, but why a not more public discussion of this, do you think, Toby?
Well, I think that, the policymakers inside the Beltway, so we have to think about not only the White House, but also the Pentagon, the State Department, and others have longstanding and complicated relationships with the Saudis. It's not only about the Saudis selling oil. It's about how the Saudis are integrated into the American arms market, into financial markets. These are all viewed as important and necessary to stabilize and to preserve. Saudi Arabia is a huge engine for weapons purchases, which, money that cycles back through the American economy. That's a lot of inertia. That's a lot of forces that align against any kind of break like in the relationship.
We have an email from Carl. Is there any truth that King Abdullah traveled with an organ donor? Also, does Saudi Arabia still chop off the hands of thieves? Bernard Haeckel?
Yes, it does still chop off the hands of thieves. It does implement Islamic law, and that is part of the legitimacy of the state, that it does do so. And it is done in public. And as far as, you know, the question of women is concerned and human rights generally, you see, the Saudis will be telling Obama today, for instance, you really want to meddle with our domestic affairs and want us to change? Would you want Saudi Arabia to look like Syria or like Yemen or like the Sinai or like Libya? Because if you want that, that's what, if you want human rights, that's what will happen. And this this use of the chaos card by the Saudis is an extremely effective one today because there is so much chaos in the Middle East.
The idea that if you want democracy, you're going to get chaos instead?
Yeah, absolutely.
You agree with that, Toby?
Yeah, that has been the line, you know, most powerfully since 9/11, but it has certainly pre-existed that as well. That, you know, there's, if you look for key words, not only in how the Saudis talk about their position, their vulnerabilities, and their relationship with the United States, but also how Obama and American policymakers will talk about it, it's about stability and security. And it is precisely this way of talking and thinking that in the absence of a strong man or in the absence of a strong Saudi royal family, what you'll have is chaos. And, you know, given the region, given the recent moment, given that it's still important with respect to global energy, there's no American policymaker that would take the risk.
Let me go back to this blogger, and I'll go back to you, Toby, because he was sentenced to 1,000 lashes and given over a period of time. Apparently, he was supposed to have his second lashing, but apparently he hadn't healed enough from the first lashing. Do you think these 1,000 lashes are going to be carried out?
Well, we've got no indication that they won't be carried out. Of course, they're staggered, implemented over a long period of time with 50 lashes at a time. The most recent round was postponed for health reasons. The first set of lashes didn't heal properly. There's a tremendous amount of pressure on Saudi Arabia. What we might see is, you know, and here I'm totally guessing, but given past practice with respect to political dissidents and political prisoners, is we may see some partial fulfillment of the punishment in order to accommodate the religious establishment, but then a royal pardon of some sort that at least sets the corporal punishment aside. I mean, I'm sure the family, if it intervenes, will try to strike a balance.
Bernard Haeckel, there's a comment from Barbara. What is their take on Princeton University professor Robert George's offer to take 100 lashes for the journalist? That's your colleague at Princeton University. I mean, I'd just be curious about the worldwide response. And there is, I think, revulsion and a degree of kind of horror about these public punishments.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not specific. I don't know whether the Saudis actually responded to Robbie George's offer at all. I don't think they have. And, you know, the point about these lashings, and actually they're not really lashings, they're canings, to be more specific, is to humiliate the individual. Right. It's not really to physically injure him. So this is not, you know, the lashing that we saw in 12 Years a Slave. Okay, and if you see videos of it, it's really little canings on the back. And the purpose is to humiliate, not to inflict physical punishment.
Although he's still healing. So obviously there was some...
I don't think so, actually. I think the reason he wasn't lashed the second time was not because of his healing or his health. It was because there was this transition, and he's very likely to be pardoned. Just like Professor Jones said, when you have a new king, often you get pardons.
So what is the shaming then about?
So the shaming is basically to send a message that no other person should think of doing what this man did, which is to get onto Twitter and onto the internet and social media and criticize the regime or ask for constitutional reforms and that sort of thing. And the other is to publicly show that Islamic law is being implemented. So if you look at the videos of the caning of Mr. Badawi, you see that a bunch of people are watching it, and at the end of it, they're all shouting Allahu Akbar, which is a sign that God's law has been implemented.
This is Sharia law, Toby?
This is Sharia law.
This is Sharia law. This is what we're seeing, Toby Jones?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I do think that it's worth thinking about. And this is the message, and it's certainly the regime's intent, along with those who would like to see this punishment carried out. There's also a great deal of opposition to it, and there's a great deal of skepticism about the power of the clergy and the religious scholars in Saudi Arabia from within Saudi Arabia itself. But we don't have, and so Badawi in many ways has been held up as representative of this sort of alternative set of voices that needs to be shamed and needs to be chastened. They don't have safe space to carry on and to confront. So the appeal to legitimacy, the appeal to the regime's claim that it's carrying out an Islamic injunction in doing so is really only targeting a particular audience in Saudi Arabia, but it's the only one that can speak publicly. And that that's important to keep in mind, too, that there is a wide range of difference. But those who might be less enthralled or supportive of all of this don't have a safe space to say so.
And by safe space, you mean they can't go out on the street, but also because he was a blogger, it's not safe on the internet either?
It's not safe on the internet unless done anonymously, right? I mean, there's quite a few Saudis on social media, Twitter and otherwise, who don't support this. But no, you can't embody your own identity and be openly critical.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about Saudi Arabia, the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States. Saudi King Abdullah died on Friday. President Obama in the country today. Talking with Toby Jones, Associate Professor of History at Rutgers University, and Bernard Haeckel. He's Professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Again, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Toby Jones and Bernard Haeckel about Saudi Arabia, the United States' relationship with Saudi Arabia. And also we'll be talking about some of the regional challenges. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I do want to get to some callers, but first I want to read a Facebook comment from Tika, who says, I hate the fact that the term Wahhabism is consistently used for the belief system of a people and also used for terrorist organizations, which goes against what the Saudis teach and believe. Toby, if I can toss that to you about the use of Wahhabism, Salafism, I guess, is another term that has been used to describe this approach to Islam.
Yeah, no, I am fully supportive that Wahhabism in many ways has become an empty analytical category. It doesn't tell us very much. It has more. I mean, I think it gets more traction because it indicts or implicates the Saudis and the royal family in particular. It doesn't tell us very much about particular actors. So I think we need to find a better way of describing all of this. But the reality is that in this country, at least, our public political rhetoric around this doesn't really leave space for complexity or subtlety. And I think Wahhabism fills a certain vacuum as a shorthand, problematically.
What would be a better word to use? Do you have one?
Well, I mean, if we want to talk about a phenomenon as a set of, as Professor Haeckel mentioned earlier, jihadism is a complicated phenomenon that's not monocausal. It has its roots in lots of different things. I mean, if we're going to be particular and specific historically, ISIS is not an outgrowth of Wahhabism. It's an outgrowth of the Iraq War and the insurgency and the American occupation there. I mean, there's no single word that captures that, but that's the reality. So maybe we just need to do away with simplicity in our coverage and discussion about it.
Indeed. Bernard, do you want to weigh in on that?
I mean, in my case, what I tend to do is use the words that people in ISIS use about themselves or people in Saudi Arabia use about themselves. So typically that's Salafism or Salafi. And that has certain theological content, so it's identifiable. But these terms are terms of art, and it's difficult for people who know nothing about Islam to understand what that means.
Let me see what Hal from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. Hal, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I understand there's a law that places of worship other than Islamic ones are not permitted in Saudi Arabia. And I'd like to know how that law came into being.
Can I toss that to you, Bernard Haeckel?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's an easy one. It's a good question, but it's an easy one to answer. It's simply because the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, said there shall be no two religions in Arabia. So this is a tradition that the Salafis and the Saudi royal family invoke to say that there will be no other house of worship in Saudi Arabia other than the Muslim one. Now, the Qataris, the country of Qatar just next door, they belong to the same religious tradition as the Saudis, but they do permit churches to be built there, and other countries in Arabia, Yemen, the UAE, and so on, also permit churches and even synagogues to be built. So it's very specific to the Saudis and their very serious literalism when it comes to the teachings of the Prophet.
Toby Jones, would it be fair to say that the Arab Spring has empowered Saudi Arabia when you look at what has happened in neighboring countries?
This is a difficult question. I mean, it's how do we measure this? The Saudis have asserted themselves, but there are also limits to their power. I mean, they've played a role in backing Sisi in Egypt. They had played a role in Yemen in bringing in a replacement for Ali Abdullah Saleh. But that replacement has now fallen from power. And is Egypt in a strong position? The Saudis, of course, sent their military, their National Guard into Bahrain. I mean, there are limits. At the same time that the Saudis have kind of flexed their muscles regionally, there are also limits to what they can accomplish, much like the United States. So, yes, they are more powerful than their weakened neighbors. But does that leave them in an overall position of strength? I'm not sure.
What do you think, Bernard?
You know, I think that in some countries they're much more powerful than in others. So in Yemen, for instance, and Bahrain, that's their backyard. And they have connections to virtually everybody in the political spectrum of those two countries. In Egypt, it's the financial backing. There's very little political influence that they can exert. Similarly, in Tunisia, where their candidates have just won the election, or at least the people that were backing have won the election. So their influence is principally financial as we move out of Arabia. And, you can pay, but that doesn't necessarily buy you influence, as you see in Syria, for instance, where they've desperately wanted to get rid of President Assad and have failed.
Well, and talking about Yemen, Bernard, I mean, what do you anticipate going forward? Saudi Arabia actually building a fence along the border between Yemen and Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I mean, good luck to them. They're building a fence also on the border with Iraq. And, if Yemen were to implode, and I think it will, and it is already a failed state, they're going to have a real problem with millions of Yemeni refugees coming across that border. And I see Yemen as really going down in a very bad way for structural reasons. I mean, they're running out of water, running out of oil. They have a massive demographic explosion, malnutrition. 60% of all kids are malnourished in Yemen. It's a real kind of catastrophe in the making.
And Toby Jones, failed states often attract terrorist organizations, kind of move into the vacuum.
Well, I mean, Yemen has a terrorist presence. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula has been active there over the last few years. And certainly, I don't know that we want to characterize it as a magnet. It has been a haven. But Yemeni policy and American policy, counterterrorism policy over the last few years has also encouraged and promoted participation and support for those groups as well. So it's not just the case that as a failed state, Yemen attracts all of this. It's also the way the state failed to manage the catastrophe that Professor Haeckel outlined, combined with the flying of drones and the targeting of individuals and the killing of lots of people, has encouraged some Yemenis to think that this is their only meaningful way forward.
I notice, again, looking at the New York Times, that there was another CIA drone strike in Yemen yesterday. Toby Jones, apparently three suspected al-Qaeda fighters who were killed on Monday. There is a drone base in southern Saudi Arabia. So one would assume the United States would be keeping up its drone attacks on Yemen.
Yeah, I mean, I have to imagine that nothing will change in that respect, that it will be status quo for the United States going forward.
Let me put something else on the table, and then we'll get back to some of our comments and also to our callers. Bernard Haeckel, Saudi Arabia is not so happy about the negotiations the United States has been having with Iran over its nuclear program. What is their concern?
Well, their concern, is that President Obama is a lame duck president who is desperate for a foreign policy success and has decided that, you know, a deal with Iran will be that success. And they feel that the Iranians, in thinking about Iran and dealing with them, it's not just about the nuclear program. It's also about Iran's influence throughout the Arab world in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and even Palestine. So they want to see Iran driven out of the Arab world and not just stop its nuclear program. So and they really dislike Iran, and they see it as a major threat to their own influence. Also, the Saudi ruling family, especially the ones in power now, remember a time when the United States was very, very close to Iran when it was under the Shah, and Iran was the principal backer, principal ally of the United States in the region. And after the Iran Revolution in 79, Saudi Arabia became that principal ally. They don't want to go back to a time when Iran replaces them.
How do you drive Iran out of the region?
Well, that's very difficult. You know, it's they've been trying very hard to do that, and the Iranians are well entrenched, certainly in Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq, because they have strong proxies and allies and people, even non-state actors, who are working on their behalf. Whereas the Saudis don't have non-state actors fighting in any of these wars directly for the Saudis.
Let me get Ali from Makunji to join us. Ali, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
Am I online?
You are. Go ahead, Ali.
Okay. Yeah, I wanted to comment about the previous comment about women not being able to drive in Saudi Arabia and some of the rhetoric around that line of democracy and human rights and so forth. Basically, I just actually came back from Saudi Arabia about 2 weeks ago. I was there for about 3 weeks. I was there in 2001 and I was there in 1998. And I've seen this country progress a lot in the last 16, 17 years. And let me tell you that I was actually taking a cab going from Jeddah to Medina, which is 400 miles of pure desert. Now, I was thinking about this particular issue about why women are not allowed to drive in this country. And I could totally understand that, because if a woman is driving across from Jeddah to Medina and her car breaks down, or God forbid she has to stop somewhere, she will be raped, because this country accommodates a lot of labor from around the world who leave their families behind, like from Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka, and the Philippines, and they leave their families behind, and they are there without their wives or spouses or significant others and so forth. So basically, there is a vulnerability of them actually committing adultery and rape.
Well, Ali, let me take your point and see if Toby Jones agrees with that. Is that why women are not allowed to drive, because they might be raped or commit adultery?
Well, I think it's an entirely, you know, unhelpful comment. I think in many ways it mimics the worst set of claims that's offered up by both Saudi policymakers and their backers, who are opposed to women driving. Appealing to some sort of special character of foreigners and laborers is troubling, in fact, to make that argument. No, there are political and religio-political reasons. Women are a convenient excuse. They're a source of leverage and power for politics that's played out between sets of men in Saudi Arabia. I don't think behavior would change radically. I don't find that a particularly persuasive way to continue to oppose half of Saudi Arabia's population from driving.
Well, and Bernard, looking at my computer screen, I thought Ali was going to be talking about the fact that over the couple of years, or the 15 years that he's gone back and forth between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, that he thinks things are better for women in that country. Do you agree with that assessment?
Not juridically. I mean, not by law. They're still in the same position, although more of them are now in the workforce, which is a good thing. And more of them are being educated at universities than men, so there's a higher percentage of women at universities. I should also add that women in rural Saudi Arabia do drive.
Right.
It's only in urban areas that they don't drive. And the reason they're not permitted to drive in urban areas is because their driving has become a symbol of the religiosity of the regime, of the legitimacy of the regime. So it's the driving. It's not just about their driving. It's also the fact that they're prevented from driving stands for much more than the act itself. And that is the problem.
To you, Toby Jones, and I'm even thinking of this blogger, but also if he represents a younger generation, looking at a younger generation in Saudi Arabia, do you see some parallels between them and the younger generation in other countries in the Middle East?
Well, sure. I mean, there's no reason to think that there wouldn't be. But the kind of politics, the sorts of expressions and ways of thinking that have settled in amongst the Saudi youth are not necessarily generational. I mean, Saudi politics has been complicated for quite a long time, as it has elsewhere. I mean, we put a lot of focus on the youth, and I think we do this routinely because it helps us explain generational breaks and patterns. But in fact, you know, Saudi Arabia has been a complicated place for a long time with lots of people who have challenged the status quo or who have accepted the status quo. And I don't think Saudi youth are any more exceptional than anywhere else, nor do I think they're necessarily dissimilar.
This is asking you, Bernard, to look in your crystal ball, but looking ahead, looking at this as this younger generation grows up, will they be willing to live under the Saud monarchy, do you think, in a generation?
I think it depends on whether the regime is able to provide the goods and the promises of jobs and services and all the goodies that have come to them. This is very much a nanny state. If the regime is allowed, or if the government can do this because the price of oil permits it, then you'll see more of the same. If the price of oil doesn't permit it and they cannot provide all the things that these young people want, then there will be problems ahead.
I have an email from Paul. He says, do we have to say, well, yes, we waterboarded at Guantanamo, we abused at Abu Ghraib, where is that? Is the Saudis really equal to beheading and cutting off hands in public square? Toby Jones, were you making that kind of equivalency?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand the comment, that the argument that there is no moral equivalency between public beheadings.
I mean, yes.
Do I think that there are powerful parallels between the United States criminalizes and maintains a massive carceral state, including the torture of people at Guantanamo Bay and the way Saudi Arabia? Absolutely. I think there's a great deal of proximity and similarity between the way we treat those we determine to be criminals, primarily African-American, impoverished. I don't think there's any question about this. This isn't even a controversial claim to make.
I guess what the emailer was saying, that in part the difference between what we do in what they do in public and perhaps what happens in private in the United States.
Well, I guess I don't put much meaning in the distinction between public and private. You behave a certain way, you behave a certain way. Whether it's captured on camera or available to be viewed doesn't change that it's happened or not.
Bernard Haykel, about a minute before we have to say goodbye here. So what do you anticipate with a new king in Saudi Arabia? Do you anticipate major changes? He's 79, almost 80 years old. I think he has had a stroke. What should we know about him?
I mean, he's a very – I've met him, by the way, several times.
Oh,
he's an extremely formal person. He's a disciplinarian of the family. I don't think that you'll see very much difference at all between him and his predecessor. It'll be more of the same. On all policies, the differences will have to do with which princes, has more power and which one does not. And by the way, before just completely signing off, I should let you know that Toby and I both are in a book that just came out called Saudi Arabian Transition.
I did not know that, and I apologize for that. What is it called again?
It's called Saudi Arabia in Transition. Cambridge University Press. It just came out about a week ago.
Well, and perfect for our discussion today. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Bernard Haykel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University, Toby Jones, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was great to be with you.
Nice to have you with us as well. Associate Professor of History at Rutgers University. Again, they have contributed to a brand new book called Saudi Arabia in Transition. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We've got hour two coming up.